Okay. Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming out. And I wish to start by thanking Stephen Bowes for, and also you, for the opportunity for me to think about something. You know, you're asked to do a paper, and you're kind of not really ready ever. And by being asked to do this, it's actually forced me to think a little bit. You'll find out how much. You'll be able to judge when you've heard it. But it's a, what I'm looking at is an absolutely essential part of aspect of fairy tales, the importance that animals and animality play in the tales. And most of them present a speaking or acting animal character, seldom an enemy, often a helper, and often as a disguise for humans to hide inside or within as a result of need or a curse made thoughtlessly for some thoughtless crime. So there's usually something lying behind the animal state if it's a human. And despite the ubiquity of animals, it's interesting to me that there are relatively few attempts in the English scholarship to work out in a global manner exactly what animals are doing in all these tales. So that's why it's very helpful to be asked to do this, because it makes you do some of the work that you thought was out there. There's a fair bit in German on this, but not in English. So I'm going to try to think about this in relation to a single collection, the Kinder- und Hausmärchen, or Children's and Household Tales of the Brothers Grimm. They were collected in the first half of the 19th century. And as I do this, I'm going to be showing you a fair number of illustrations of the stories made in the 19th and 20th century. And these images are interpretations of the story that I'm talking about. And they provide a kind of secondary commentary on the place of animals in Tales of Grimm. There are a lot of pictures of the animals. And this one up here, what I'd like to know is how many animals are actually in this picture? Trick question. Because there are actually two humans there. One is temporarily there in the guise of a deer. So fairy tales and the vast range of original children's literature they have spawned since the 19th century have become a central feature of our orientation to animals, and that's why I think it's probably relevant to the series here. We learn to speak with animals, to distrust or trust them, to recognize our own animality through them, as well as to define our humanity in relation to them. And it's hard to shake the power of the tales. Just last weekend, we had a mouse in our house, trapped in a blue box. And so the question is, to kill or to forgive? And the tales are very clear. After you've spoken kindly to the mouse, you release it. Right now, this mouse is probably in a neighbor's kitchen, or maybe back in our house, feasting on scraps that have fallen in a corner and crapping all over the place. Someday, however, I will trip on the stairs, and that mouse had better be there to call 911. The power of the narratives that we absorb when we're young are remarkably powerful. When I was little, I had rheumatic fever, and the cure back then was to put you in a hospital for a long time. And this period of immobility and weakness turned out to be a central advantage in my life, because that's where I mastered the art of reading. And the thing that I read most enjoyably were Uncle Scrooge comics. Uncle Scrooge, the richest being on the planet, who gained his wealth and retained every penny, not through superpowers, but through vigorous action, total self-reliance, canny intelligence, and stinginess. And I was devoted to this remarkable duck when he was off on his adventures with Donald and Huey, Dewey, and Louie, and I was transported away from my hospital bed into a marvelous other world. So here's Uncle Scrooge relaxing in his money bath in one of the first tales that was published in 1951. I hesitate to say this is about the time I was reading them, but it actually was. And Scrooge is accompanied by his nephew, Donald. And what caught my interest when I was young was the sheer exuberance of Uncle Scrooge during this daily swim that he took in the money pool. But what I notice now is that Uncle Scrooge remarkably compares himself to a porpoise. So it says, I dive around in it like a porpoise. And in the next frame, in the next panel in the story, the comparison's ramped up. Donald compares him to a gopher. You burrow through your money like the like a gopher. And what's happening here is a little odd. Isn't a duck good enough to swim and dive in a pool of money? It turns out that Scrooge just looks like a duck. And here's another panel from another story about the same period. So let's go eat, kids. Just for a minute there, I thought Uncle Scrooge was human. And now apparently he's not behaving like a human, and that seems odd, seeing that it is visually apparent that he really is a duck. But the key thing about Scrooge, I swiftly determined as a child, is that he is a duck, but he is also remarkably human. So as you've got the two things together in him. He looks like a duck. In fact, he is a duck, but he acts like a human. The principal characteristic of this aspect of his humanity is, I would now argue, his capacity for speech, which includes his ability to tell tales, recount his own personal history, verbalize his strategic plans, as he does when he goes out and out-tricks his enemies, the Beagle Boys. And we could go on at length about Uncle Scrooge, and we're going to move to the fairy tales. But my point here is that the same principle pertains to the animals in the fairy tales. And it's no surprise because the Disney writers were exceptionally attuned to fairy tale culture, and Scrooge really is, I believe, a direct descendant of the speaking characters you find in the tales. So, the second story in the Grimm's collection is called The Companionship of the Cat and the Mouse. These two animals conspire together to steal a jar of fat. And the cat tells the mouse, after they've hidden this jar, that he's heading off each day to visit his godchildren. But instead, he visits the jar of fat that they've hidden. And on the first day, he comes back and tells the mouse, I've just been visiting my godchild named Top Off. The second day, is the godchild's name is Half Gone. And the third day, the godchild seems to be named All Gone. The mouse now figures that something is happening, and together they go visit the hidden jar. Now I know what happened, says the mouse. You ate it all up. First the skin on the top, then half. Enough, yelled the cat. One more word and I'll eat you all up. All Gone was already in the tip of the mouse's tongue, and no sooner did she say it than the cat jumped on her and devoured her. You see, that's the way of the world. That's how it ends. Surely, what we have here is a form of a fable, which is like a moral tale, here expanded to include what the folklorists call the epic rule of three. That is, you have to have three visits to the jar. And an essential part of the fable has been retained, and that is, at the end of the fable, there's this moral, what the ancients called the epimetheum, and the moral in this fable is impossibly broad. That's the way of the world. And the message is, cats are cats, mice are mice, cats kill mice, and so it shall always be. Now, just as in Disney's DuckTales, what is remarkable and barely noticed when we read these tales is that the animals are talking to one another. Not only do they speak, but some of them, like the cat in this tale, are rather witty in their verbal plays. Their capacity of speech is also true of other animals in fairy tales, when humans can also speak with them, such as the wolf and Little Red Cap, or the duck and the two travelers. And we'll get to some of these stories, but right now we're looking at the stories in which animals all address each other in human language. So we're going to look at animals talking to animals. One of the best-loved tales in Grimm is that of the Bremerton musicians. This is a story of the ass, the dog, the cat, and the rooster who joined together and decide to become a musical group. And they're wandering around. They're at night. They're looking for a place to stay. They find a house near the woods where they are, and it's occupied by thieves. And apparently they can recognize by their behavior. And so they begin to sing. And they terrify these depraved human thieves and drive them away. And interestingly, the animals all speak normally with each other, but when they start to sing, suddenly they're singing in the language of animals. And so that's the picture of when they, it's by Cruikshank, of when they actually break into the room. The other picture, they're just outside. What are we supposed to make of these speaking animals in Grimm? And they're part of a long tradition of the fable. The fables such as the tale of the fox who tricks the crow into releasing the piece of cheese, or the rooster who rules the dunghill, are short narratives with an overt moral at the end. And they're all descended from a collection ascribed to the ancient Greek slave Aesop. But they're hugely expanded in late antiquity and in the Renaissance, where they're actively collected and imitated, and you have these vast collections which are all put together, generally under the name of Aesop, even though Aesop may never even have done any of them. But that's the way that they're organized. And the genre was still very much alive in the 18th century when the Grimms received their own education. And not only were people continuing to write fables, they were developing interesting theories of the fable. And so I believe it's to thinkers like Lessing and Herder, who are contemporaries, that we should turn to resolve one of the basic features of the fable, and that is the fact that animals speak human language to each other. Talking animals is a feature that Lessing considered to be almost not worthy of notice. So in a five-part study of fables published in 1759, Lessing has this to say. In brief, that animals and other lesser creatures have language and reason is presupposed in fables. It is assumed and should not at all be understood as miraculous. Typo. When I read in scripture that the Lord opened the donkey's mouth and she said to Balaam, etc., I am reading something miraculous. But when I read in Aesop, back in the days when animals still spoke and the sheep said to the shepherd, it is quite evident that the fabulist does not wish to relate anything miraculous, but much more, rather, something that he supposes with the permission of his reader to have been perfectly in accordance with the common course of nature at the time. So animals talking normal, even though when you think about it, it's kind of strange. And when I was going through Little Red Riding Hood with a class a little while ago, and we were talking about, you know, the fact that the wolf could speak. And I said, that's, you know, we're looking for the marvelous feature of Little Red Riding Hood, and that must be one of them. But I'm now retracting that position, because the fact that the wolf can speak is actually normal. The wolf is a fable character. The discussion about this was taken up by the philosopher Herder, Johann Gottfried Herder, who was a hugely important influence on the Grimms and in their work on the collecting of tales. And he wrote an essay called On Image, Poetry, and Fable. And it goes, in their whole dispensation of life, animals are organization just like man is. They merely lack human organization and the prodigious instrument of our abstract symbolic memories, speech. Thus, talking animals are not really an arbitrary contrivance to arouse wonder, but an ancient belief rooted in the delusions of sensuous men, passed down from oldest times. So it's an interesting problem that they obviously are trying to cope with here, which is the fact of speaking animals. And Herder here agrees with Lessing, even though he doesn't in other parts of his essay, and the convention of animal speech is so ancient that it's considered by them to be a natural part of our expectations as recipients of old tales. The point of the fable is to teach us practical wisdom by having the animals display human qualities without being human. So, for Herder, the fox talks and acts as a fox. The lion talks and acts as a lion. And this is his qualification. This, in the Aesopian fable, every animal speaks precisely only in its sphere, in keeping with its character, not as a man, but like a man, or like man generally, actually. I think that's important. Not as a man, but like man. So the human soul, as it were, dispersed among all the various animal characters, and the fable seeks only here and there to fashion the scattered reason into a whole. So in the light of what Herder has to say, I'm encouraged to take this aspect of human speech a bit further. Many fairy tales are fables, and these fables, which are short commentaries on human behavior, the animals discuss and argue all kinds of things. We get to overhear them easily, and the fact that they speak to each other after many times, a story seems insignificant. So you've got in Grimm, the mouse and the cat, the wolf, the goat, and her seven kids. We'll take a look at that in a minute. The fox and the cat, the old dog Sultan and the wolf, the hare and the hedgehog, and so on. Just a whole range of stories. Yet, the fact that they speak situates them in language, which is structured around moral categories. So the point that is important for all fairy tales, most of which have no explicit moral, is that the language moralizes the action. Now, this is a little bit complicated. This is my little theory about the fairy tales, is that there are no morals at the end of a proper fairy tale. There are in some of these fabled stories, but not at the end of the story. And yet, they're extremely moral. So you, and people can draw conclusions from them, but the weird thing is, you can draw absolutely opposite conclusions from the same story. So who's at fault in Little Red Riding Hood is a standard question I ask people. And people say, well, it's the wolf. And really you have to say, well, the wolf's just being a wolf here. So maybe it's the little girl. Well, or is it the mother who didn't properly prepare the little girl, like the adults in the story? You can't, all you know is that something happened, there's moral implications, but you can't lock the story down. And that's the interesting thing about the fairy tales, and that's something I'm going to keep pushing in this. So let's have a look at the wolf and the seven kids. So in this story, there's a wolf out there, they know about this, and in the story, there are seven little goats who are left in the house by the mother who goes away, and the wolf comes in and devours all but one of the goats, which is the youngest. And the youngest one, through various trickeries, manages to, the wolf eats all of the other goats, lies there, stuffed, and then has to be dealt with by the mother goat and the remaining baby goat. And basically they cut open the stomach of the wolf, extract the little kids, throw in some rocks, sew the wolf back up again. This is one of the standard ends of Little Red Riding Hood. And in this picture here, you may have trouble seeing the wolf, but there's this little bubble in the middle of the pool there, and that's where the wolf is gone. Because basically, the wolf's been tossed into the well and is drowned because of the rocks inside it. So what you have at the end is, the wolf is dead, the wolf is dead, and the goats are jumping up and down, the kids are happy, and innocence and good-heartedness triumph over this rapacity and evil. But they do this all in the language of humans. The moral is clear, the animals retain their non-human status, the animals remain free in a sense because they've not been tied to a particular allegorical meaning, it's just, this is what happened. So now I think it's time to look at what the Grimms were doing. So I'm going to give a little background on this. Because the condition of the collection helped part of the reason, the condition of the way they collected is important for the way that the tales actually are received and the way we read them. So Wilhelm and Jacob Grimm came from a large family, and some of whom participated in the work, such as Ludwig, who's an artist who illustrated some of the tales. And the brothers were trained in philosophy, language, history, and law. And early on, they were very excited by the work of Herder, who I've just talked about, who was proposing a kind of nationalist enterprise of locating a true German tradition that was buried away in old laws, ballads, poems, tales, legends, and other artifacts of the old culture. And the idea for the Grimms was that a story is a kind of repository of an old truth, The story keeps being told, and somewhere back there, it's telling you some ancient truth that is important to know, and is also part of the culture. And the idea of collecting these lost materials was started by other colleagues about the same time, but the brothers Grimm soon became leaders in the work. And the knowledge of the old ways and authentic culture is buried in folk customs and language. And it's through the process of storytelling, as the stories are passed on, this is their idea, that it's like little, they describe it as little seeds left by the side of the road after everything's been swept up, you know, after the farmers have come and taken everything. There's these little seed corns that are left, and that's what they're after. They're after the little seed corns. And the seed corns are being passed around by people telling stories and passing them on verbally or orally from one person to the next, and the story gets altered and changed over time, but it, the essence of the story keeps passing on. And so it'll be a scene like this of, you know, this will be like an old wives' tale or, you know, a kind of Mother Goose situation or something like that, where an old woman is telling stories to the children, the stories, the kids remember it, they pass the story on. And a lot of this was also done by adults at the same time. And so collecting tales and legends are a clue to the discovery of ancient and authentic, uncorrupted German culture, and they're therefore kind of like a clue to what we are as Germans, because Germany was emerging as a nation state at the end of the 18th century and into the early 19th century. The first edition of their children's household tales came out in 1812, the second volume in 1815. So last year, there was quite a fuss over this because it was the bicentenary of the publication of the first volume of the Grimm's work. And but that, no one bought it, you know, when it came out. No one was interested in it. And it was only when they did a little short version, like a Kleine Ausgabe, it's called, a small edition, that came out, that people got interested in these stories, the tales took off. And curiously, the small edition was actually modeled on this by George Cruikshank. And so it's like they found the English translation with the nice pictures, and I thought, oh, that's a great idea. We'll do one ourselves. And so the stories became popular then. Now, by 1857, the stories, and most people don't read all of Grimm. You know, I think it's very unusual to have a conversation about someone who's really talking about all of Grimm. We're really, we probably, most people know, you know, a dozen or two dozen of the stories. There are people who write a lot about them will know more, but often people are concentrating on one area of this kind of stuff. So there are 210 stories, and there's a group of children's legends which are added at the end, but animal tales, the kind that we started with, like the Wolf and the Seven Kids, that's a, there's 27 of those. And then there are tales of peasant life, of riddles and moral tales and other short forms. There's 49 of those. And I have to say, those stories are highly amusing, but they would not normally be classified as fairy tales for a lot of people. They're usually stories about incredibly stupid people. And they're amusing, and some of them have made it into the kind of into children's literature. But most of them are, the people are so stupid, and the conversations are so strange that they haven't made it. And one reason why the conversation is strange is because they've been kept by the Grimms in dialect, because they're interested in the dialect way, the dialect form of these conversations, which have been passed on. What we're really focusing on, and which is really the thing that we're, you know, kind of traditionally interested in, are what the scholars call Zaubermärchen, or magic tales. So these are the 124 tales of strange quests, travels abroad and through dark forests, and strange enemies, and unexpected friendships, and tiny helpers, or giant creatures, magic trees, seven-league boots, and transformation of animals into humans, and humans into animals, which is really what we're going to be talking about. And despite the claims made by the Grimms, they're providing authentic transcriptions from German peasants. Many of the stories came to them from written sources or from individuals with a more bourgeois background. But the, and also, the Grimms revised their tales. sometimes quite extensively. And so they tended to moralize the stories and to bring Christian virtues into them as they rewrote them over time. But even with their revisions, and with the exception of a few clear fables that are in the collection, the magic tales do not get turned into moral tales. There's something that resists being turned into moral tales. And so at the time, people liked to comment on fairy tales. And so as a German poet and philosopher, Novalis, nothing goes more against the spirit of the fairy tale than a regulated coherence. In other words, these are very nutty stories. And we like them for it. In a genuine fairy tale, everything must be incoherent, taking it a step further. And so what you've got is a demand on the reader to accept the fairy tale as something that it doesn't really make sense. And what I'm going to try and show is how that ties to the language aspect of the thing in the tales. So the open form of the narrative, which is a repeatable skeleton that's passed on orally, kind of resists closure. Like, you can interpret it different ways. I can tell the story one way, you can tell it another. You can add a little something to the story if you want. You can take something away. And the story structure somehow travels on. And so the Grimms, despite their attempts to fiddle with the stories and add kind of Christian morals to it now and then, and you can compare, there's online, there's great examples of, you know, the 1812 version and the 1857 version. One's been like really changed from one to the next. They still are unable to lock the story down. And that's the interesting feature of this. The marvelous and the sense of wonder are not lost. And they are constructed around moral categories. There's lots of morality in the stories, but they remain open for interpretation. And so they don't wrap themselves up in some kind of shell and lock themselves down. So unlike fables and animal tales, the magic tales are essentially tales about humans. The animals serve a role in them, but they're really about humans. And there are tales in which animals assist humans, tales in which they oppose them. There are tales in which animals turn out to be humans, and tales in which humans conceal themselves from enemies by clothing themselves as animals. The constant presence of animals speaks back to the time when the tales of the Grimm were collected and circulated in a rural society when everyone lived close to animals, domestic and wild. And an excellent story that's going to provide a transition to this magic world is maybe not the one that you know, be interested to know, something called The Three Languages, about someone who learns the language of animals. Does anyone know this story? Yeah, it's interesting. So in my telling, I changed the text just a little bit, and there's a recent translation by Philip Pullman, just came out just a couple of months ago, and that's what he does. He takes the stories and kind of changes them just a little bit. They're excellent versions, I think. There once, this is mine though, there once was an old count who lived in Switzerland, and he had only one son, who was quite stupid and could not learn anything. So the father sends him away to study with a famous teacher. After a year, the son returned home. "Well," asked the father, "what did you learn?" "I learned to understand the barking of dogs." "That's ridiculous," said the father. So he sent him off to another teacher in another town. A year later, the son returned. "Well, what have you learned?" the father asked. "I learned to understand the language of birds." The father exploded. "That's even more stupid." And he sent him away to another city and to another teacher. And at the end of that year, the boy returned and reported back happily. "This time, I learned the language of frogs." The father, by this point, had given up on his son. He ordered him, this is very fairy tale-like, to be taken to the forest and killed. It's a bit harsh. Of course, the men who were tasked with this distasteful activity liked the boy, and they let him go and brought back the eyes and tongue of a deer to prove that they had followed the old count's orders. So anyway, so now we're rid of the old count, in a sense. That part's closed down. Now the boy wanders about until he came to a castle and asked for a place to stay for the night. The master of the castle said, "You can sleep in the old tower, But you should know that the tower is infested with wild dogs, and they've been known to kill passersby. The boy said he'd do it. And when he arrived, the dogs stopped barking and gathered around him. The next morning, he told the master what the dogs had told him. They're misbehaving because they're under a curse. They're compelled to protect a great treasure under the tower. They'll only find peace if the treasure is dug up. So the master digs up the treasure, and of course, the dogs were now quiet, and the master of the tower was rich. So that was a happy little conclusion. The boy left this place and wandered further south. He went past a marsh and listened to the croaking of the frogs. There he learned that the Pope was ill and likely to die. It's amazing what you listen, you know, when you attend to the frogs, what they've got to tell you. When he got to Rome, he learned that the cardinals were having trouble choosing a pope. They had decided that they would obey a divine sign. And as the young man entered the church, two doves descended from above and landed on his shoulders. He was immediately acclaimed, and then he was asked to celebrate Mass. Of course, the young man was a simpleton and didn't know the words, but the doves whispered the words into his ears, and he prospered afterwards. So, what you have there is a, like in Grimm, usually have the father and the sons not too happy with one another. The son turns out to be right almost always in Grimm. The father's always wrong. The reader is rewarded for the violence of the father by the incredible success of the son at the end of the story. And the fact that a simpleton can become a pope would probably be very pleasing to those who are Lutherans or other Protestants who are telling the story back in the day. So all in all, a very gratifying tale. But for me, the most exquisite part of the tale is the aspect that removes it from fable, because there's a fabulous kind of quality to it. But it's that the young man has actually learned to understand the language of dogs, frogs, and birds. What we would give for this anciently longed-for skill, to be able, like the saintly Apollonius of Tyana, who spoke with sparrows, or like my other childhood hero, Dr. Doolittle of Puddleby on the Marsh, who could communicate with Gub Gub the pig, Dab Dab the duck, and the unusual Push Me Pull You. Communicating with animals is an ancient longing, and there are many ways to do this in world mythologies. In the classical tradition, Tiresias, for instance, learned the language of birds by having his ears cleaned by Athena. And in northern mythology, Siegfried gained this power by tasting the blood of a dragon. And this latter idea, the idea of eating snakes or snake blood, is actually present in another Grimm story called The White Snake. And here, it's a king who has this power to understand animals. And as a servant discovers, it comes to the king from eating the flesh of a white snake. And so the servant partakes as well and sets off on a journey. And I see everything's shut down here, so we'll see what happens. Yeah, so there he is. He's talking to a fish. And you go through the same thing, fish, ants, and ravens. And in each instance, because of his generosity in helping the animals who have called for his help, he's rewarded. And in the end, he marries the princess. Speaking with animals is a wonderful gift. But the truth is, the fairy tales often give you this gift directly. Like, you don't have to spend time with a teacher, and you don't have to eat a piece of snake in order to understand the animals in the fairy tales. So speaking with animals is, as Lessing claimed, unexceptional. And so let's take a few look at a few of these. So one of the oddest and most interesting moments in Grimm is when Gretel calls out to the duck. Do we remember this at the end of Hansel and Gretel? Okay. Hansel and Gretel, we do know this story, don't we? All about, you know, gotten rid by the evil mother or stepmother? Well, it depends which version you look at. And so you've got your the evil stepmother there, let's call it, sends the kid off. She is replaced by something even worse, which is the witch. So it's all about eating and cannibalism and stuff like that. And at the end, who saves the day? Gretel. And so as she's leaving, as they're leaving, Gretel, they come to a river, and they have to cross the river, and how do they do this? And this is a weird ending to the story. It doesn't really fit with the rest of the story, but it's there. And so Gretel calls out to the duck. There's a white duck swimming over there. It's bound to come across if I ask it. Then she cried out, help us, little duck. We're Hansel and Gretel, out of luck. We can't get over, try as we may. Please take us over right away. Rather loose translation of the German, but anyway. So the duck comes over, and Hansel climbs on board, and he asks Gretel to join him. But she says, that will be too heavy for the little duck. Let it carry us across one at a time. The little duck did just that. And so they then are able to go back home to the father, who turns out the stepmother has died, conveniently. They're reunited with the father, and they live happily ever after because they're carrying pocketfuls of wealth that they've taken from the witch's cottage, and not just, you know, baked goods. So so this little ending to the Hansel and Gretel story, I'll show you another picture in a second, is it could be a remnant from an oral telling. Like often people would tag on these little oral things picked up from another story, and some of the stories got folded together. But in this case, we actually know it was the Grimms who wrote the this fresh conclusion, Wilhelm Grimm. And so it's odd the way this has happened. And it may be he's trying to give it a more oral flavor. It's unclear. But I can't leave this story without two things. One is, it really should be called Gretel and Hansel. Because Gretel is the one who takes charge at the end of the story. It's really, she's the one. Hansel looks like he's taking charge at the beginning. He just gets them into trouble, right? And the other part is, the other thing I just want to show you is this picture here, a 19th century chromolithograph by someone named Karl Ofterdinger. And you notice it's almost like he's been reading Hans Christian Andersen or something like that. The duck is now a swan, and it's actually like an amusement park sized swan. So anyway, you've got, it's interesting someone would actually violate the tale in that way, but so it is. Now, the sympathetic relationship with the animal world is presented in a few fragments called, in one set of fragments, they're called Tales About Toads. And in one of these little narratives, it's just a page and a half or so in a normal book, a girl has found a toad in the garden, and every day she shares her meal with the creature. And if the toad is late, she'd call out, "Toad, toad, it's time to come. Be so good, we'll have some fun. I brought you bread and milk to eat. Toad, toad, come and take your seat." And the toad would come and they would eat together. And one day the toad was slow to start eating. So the girl, in a friendly gesture, tapped the toad on the head with her spoon. The mother was watching and thought, "Wow, this toad is doing something really bad here." And obviously the girl is trying to sort of fight the toad off. So she killed the toad. And here's how the story ends. So long as the toad had eaten with her, she had grown big and strong. Now she lost her beautiful rosy cheeks and became thinner by the day. It was not long before the owl, the bird of ill omen, began to screech in the night, and the robin gathered twigs and leaves for a funeral wreath. Soon thereafter, the child lay in her coffin. So that's why, you know, that one doesn't make it into your normal kiddies lit offerings. But the, it's the tale is really about a pathos that emerges because of this, but it's the relationship between the girl and the animal. And in fact, the other animals are recognizing it. So the owl and the robin are kind of alert to this. And so what the tale can be read at is some kind of warning or some kind of like strange message that to harm the animal world is to harm the sympathetic relationship between animals and the world of humans. Or, you know, like you have to keep these worlds, they have to be kept apart, but they have to be kept in harmony. And there's another fairly gruesome story called The Two Travelers, about a sadistic shoemaker and a free-spirited and generous tailor. They're traveling together and the tailor is running out of food. So the shoemaker offers food, but in exchange he insists, if I give you food, I want to take out your eyes. He hates him because he's cheerful and people like to hire him and they don't like to hire the shoemaker, so he's kind of envious of him. After the tailor recovers from having been blinded by the shoemaker and having miraculously had his sight restored, actually by the advice of two dead men who are hanging behind him at a point in the story, he's walking towards the city. And first he encounters a young horse who is about to mount him when the horse begs him to stay free, to let him stay free. And the horse says, even a tailor as light as you would break my back in two. Let me go free and grow strong. Perhaps there'll be a time when I can repay you. And he threatens to eat a stork he catches because he's hungry, and his stork puts him off as well. Then he finds a young duck, but its mother says to him, just think how your mother would grieve if someone were to catch you and put an end to your life. Calm yourself, said the tailor, your children are safe. Finally, he's warned off from a hive full of honey by a queen bee who threatens to sting him, and perhaps will do you a service in return some other day. To any reader of fairy tales who does not know the actual tale, the result is going to be obvious, and that is these creatures save the tailor's life and help him to marry the beautiful princess. But the interesting thing is the language of the bargains, all of these bargains are future-oriented. So there's a certain kind of language or exchange, language exchange that occurs between the animals and humans. And they're contractual. If you fail the contract, you will be punished. This happens to a lot of older brothers. Only the young brothers seem to get along with animals. Or older sisters and things like that get punished. Younger ones survive. They're always going for youth here. So now the animal motif is carried furthest in, or in a most kind of bizarre way, in a tale called The Goose Girl. So this girl is really a princess whose position's been usurped by a false companion, and she's now hiding in disguise in a new city, and she's forced to care for a flock of geese. And her enemy has even killed her horse. Her horse is named Falada. It's one of the few animals that actually gets named in one of these stories. And she's put the dead horse's head on a city wall as kind of like a cruel reminder to this goose girl who has to walk past the horse every day and who is, alone and suffering and all that because she's been, and she's a princess, but she's been dispossessed and all this. So, and this enemy of hers, her former companion, had done this because she was afraid the horse would tell people about what she'd done to the goose girl. However, not without some irony, the crime against the horse has unexpected outcome. The horse can now speak. And so when she walks past the dead horse, the goose girl would say, oh, my poor Falada, I see you hanging there. And the horse's head would answer, dear queen, is that really you there? If your mother knew, her heart would break in two. And other people witness this exchange, and the king is informed about the false princess who's displaced the goose girl, and in a common trick at the end, this happens quite often in the stories, you ask the person who you know has committed the crime, what would be the best punishment that you could think of? This person doesn't know that they're on trial, that you could think of to punish someone for this particular crime, and they describe it. And the false bride in this case answers, and this is a digression, but I can't help it because it's just so over the top. The false bride answers, she deserves nothing better than to be stripped completely naked and put inside a barrel studded with sharp nails. Then, two white horses should be harnessed to the barrel and made to drag her through the streets until she's dead. When the sentence had been carried out, the young king married his true bride, and they both reigned over the kingdom in peace and bliss. So, and it's interesting, the illustrators will only go so far with this kind of thing. You have to know the story quite well to know that there's actually, inside that barrel, there's a woman. Here, the horse Falada, even in death, is able to account for the past. So this is the kind of thing, I'm interested with language. Are they using past? They're using future bargains, and here's a historical account of something that's explaining something in the past. And in fact, the horse is also, in a way, setting new terms for the future. And the only thing I find regrettable about this tale is the horse is not brought back to life at the end, which could easily be managed if you, you know, spend a minute or two working it out. So helpers in the Grimm tales are often animals, you know, but you've got dwarves, gnomes, old people, and the like often take up the role. And Rumpelstiltskin, for instance, is one of these helpers who goes bad. You know, it's like a kind of like a helper who goes rogue on them. And so he is self-punished. And you get this occasionally in stories and the ones coming up. So as we can see, the helpers are present to test the sympathetic capacity of a character. As when the simple brother and the queen bee protects ants, ducks, and bees from the brothers who wish to molest them in various ways. So his older brothers are cruel to them. And then so here he is with ants. You know, pretty unusual. Ducks have found a key for him. And at the end of the thing here, the bee goes and puts honey on the lips of this woman. And that revives her. And the man ends up marrying her. So in the end, the older brothers see him wed the princess. So they get to marry the sisters, which is pretty good. Normally, the brothers are sent away or punished in some way, but in this case, the story is nice to them. You've got these kinds of different roles in this. This is Cinderella, and people often forget in Cinderella what the pigeons do. First of all, they help Cinderella, and they help her find the lentils near the fire before she's allowed to go off to the ball. But they also, at the end, peck out the eyes of the sisters. And so, there are different versions of this one. And but this is the helpers can go both ways. The thing is, are they acting independently of their role in the story, or is there something particularly animal about them, or is there something, some kind of moral quality about them? How are we supposed to read this? When the helpers speak, they can supplicate, they can ask for things, they can make contracts, they can predict the future, they can explain the past. But they rarely enter into actual sustained relations with other humans. You very rarely have a sustained animal helper. It does happen, but not that often. And they're met along the road or in the forest, but they're rarely asked to step in the household and to hang around. Now, there is a major exception to this, and that is Puss in Boots. So this tale was originally written by Charles Perrault in 1697, and it got into the first edition of Grimm, but it was removed by the second edition because the Grimms realized this is awfully close to something that's actually in print and easily available, so it's not really like oral tradition that's been passing this around. In fact, it really was passed around a lot orally, but they were kind of like trying to be pure about this. Nevertheless, so they didn't treat it as an authentic tale of the folk. But Puss in Boots is the best known of animal helpers. And he speaks articulately to the king, to commoners. He outwits his magical foes through clever commands. And in Perrault's version, he remains in the household of his happily married master as a minister of state at the end of the story. Of course, you've got to know that remaining there is not a good idea. And Perrault doesn't really deal with this. But Perrault had a model for his story, which was something by someone named Jean-Baptiste Basile, which was published about 60 years earlier. And interestingly, in this version, the master cat, in the end, leaves the household because he's been mistreated by his thoughtless and very human owner. So that in fact, you know, like I, and in my view, I think Basile's ending is closer to what we normally see in Grimm. But anyway, this story didn't actually make it in there in the end. So it's, but it's an interesting thing. And you don't have animals, like, rule. Animals do not become humans, except for one instance. But humans become animals, and they're always changed back to humans. That's what the story's all about. So we're going to look at this whole aspect of the thing, and we're going to move from language now with other animals. Then we're going to, okay, we've looked at animals speaking human language. We talked a little about that. Then we've looked at the way animals and humans interact in ways that have mutual impact, this donor thing. And now we're going to move to what does it mean for a human to become an animal? This is a topic that probably deserves a whole paper on its own. And there are many tales that present this kind of metamorphosis. It's really one of the most central kinds of magic action that occurs in the stories. So we'll just start with the first story in Grimm, which kind of sets the tone for all of this, which is the Frog King. And the princess is playing with her golden ball. Falls into the well. She begins to weep and wail until she's interrupted by a voice. What's the matter, princess? Your tears could move even a stone to pity. And she looked around to see where the voice was coming from and saw a frog sticking its thick, ugly head out of the water. Oh, it's you, you old water splasher. I'm crying because my golden ball has fallen in the well. The frog tells her that he will fetch the ball, but what will he get in return? And he does not want gold or jewels, but let me be your companion and playmate. Let me sit beside you at the table, eat from your little golden plate, drink out of your little cup, and sleep in your little bed. If you promise me all that, I'll dive down and get the golden ball. And the princess, of course, says yes, unthinkingly. And interestingly enough, comments, what nonsense that stupid frog talks. He just sits there in the water, croaking with the rest of the frogs. So you've got this kind of like weird thing right at the beginning of the Grimm's collection. The frog talking or croaking? What actually is going on here? But there's having a straight communication with the girl. Now, in the stories we've already seen, the princess understands the frog. So the narrative is already asking us to suspend judgment. And as we've also seen, the language between them involves a contract. There's an obligation here. And the rest of the story leads her to having to accept the contract even though she wants to evade it. And the frog persistently seeks his part of the bargain, and the father insists the contract be maintained, interestingly. And the end result in this version by Grimm is that the moment when the frog insists on being taken into her bed, he wants to be taken into the bed, and in a fury, not like the kissing thing, in a fury, the princess picks up the frog and hurls it against the wall. Splat. And now, this is the miracle in the story. The frog turns into a handsome young man who also happens to be a prince with a kind and beautiful eyes and all this kind of stuff. And you would think that a kiss should do the job because that's the way it's turned into. But in the Grimm story, the prince emerges out of a violent rejection. And in my view, that's probably a truer vision of the relations between men and women. The Frog King is kind of an amalgam of tales. It's a helper tale. You know, you've got that thing at the beginning. And then the contract is highly exigent. So after a while, the frog has lost the status of helper and has become a dreadful nuisance, like a Rumpelstiltskin. And the frustration of the girl leads to the discovery of this hidden prince. And the marriage that follows just completes what by now is the standard pattern. The Frog King belongs to a group that are classified by folklorists as animal bridegroom tales. And there's a bunch of them in Grimm. And the most ancient example of this is the story of Cupid's Psyche in Apuleius' novel, The Golden Ass. And you also find this in, this a story called the Singing Soaring Lark. Singing Springing Lark, whoops, the Juniper Tree. Where am I? I'm lost in here now. I will just figure it out in a second. I lost my PowerPoint. I'll get back to it in a second. Oh, yes, good. We can do it. So, singing, soaring lark, old woman in the wood, the donkey, and other stories like this. But the weirdest story of them all has got to be Hans my Hedgehog, which is tale 108. And this tale is a true hybridization of human and animal. And is a perfect example of what Novalis referred to as incoherence, that in this case nevertheless coheres somehow. And so, I don't know how many of you know this story, Hans my Hedgehog? A couple of people? One? Okay. One and a half? Yeah. It's about a hedgehog. A couple of longed for a child, and the mother says she would even take a hedgehog for a child in a kind of careless moment. Well, 9 months later, that's what she gets. And they name the child Hans my Hedgehog. The father's horrified at this half-human, half-hedgehog and becomes increasingly cruel as the child gets older. So the hedgehog wants to leave home, so he asks his father to shoo the rooster, get him some bagpipes, give him a few animals, and he'll go away into the woods and leave the family. Now, it's the shooing the rooster thing and the, you know, riding, a hedgehog riding on a rooster. Seems a little weird here. And out in the woods, he sits in a rooster high in a tree playing his bagpipes and looking after his animals. And a king comes by, and in exchange for direction, the hedgehog gets him to offer the first thing that meets on his return, he's going to meet on his return home. Well, what's that going to be? It's always the daughter. And another king comes by, also lost. The same bargain is made with the same result. Time passes, and the hedgehog goes off to collect his bargain from the first king. But the daughter is so repulsed by him that in his anger, he sticks her with his quills and sends her back to her father. So he's like, she rejects him, he gets angry at her, and he just, like, quills her. And and in a lot of versions, the woman gets killed in animal bridegroom stories. There's usually two deaths, and then the third one is okay. But in this case, we're just having two. So then he rides off on his rooster to the second king. And here he is greeted and interestingly accepted, and he's married. And because the second bride accepts him on the wedding night, he strips off his hedgehog skin, and at his command, the skin is thrown into a fire, and it turns out he's really a handsome man, and the two live happily ever after. Now, this hybrid creature actually emerged from two human parents. So there's a kind of a mystery already of like what went wrong. There was no evil person making a curse. It was just the woman saying something thoughtless. And this was the result. And in the end, Hans is not a hedgehog, but a human. And so the tale is a kind of a quest narrative in which boy leaves his home to become a man, recuperate into society through material success and marriage, you know, like you bring someone into the fold, and the true identity as a man is assumed on his wedding night, and the bestial skin is burned as a sign of this final entry. And I have to say, the curious thing in this tale is the lack of any explicit curse. Anyway, how hard is this to illustrate? I'll show you how hard it is. So there's the mother with the hedgehog, and there's a young hedgehog creature. There's an excellent film version of Jim Henson, the storyteller. It's online, got to see it, it's really good. And that's his version of the hedgehog. This is the more kind of kiddie version of it, which is amazing to think that it's been turned into a real children's story. And so anyway, you can see, it's interesting. So. That's another one there. So that's Singing Springing Lark there. And in that story, the animal bridegroom is a lion who gets married to the princess. So Beauty and the Beast is the best example of this kind of story, the animal bridegroom. But I'm not going to really discuss it in detail because it never made it into Grimm. It was a fully written out story. It was first published by this Madame de Villeneuve in around 1740, and it was rewritten by Madame le Prince de Beaumont in 1756. And it really is, it's come to be the ultimate version of this animal bridegroom story. And here are just a few illustrations of it. So, people have a problem with what a beast looks like. So in this one, it's kind of like some kind of indeterminate creature. Not sure what you'd compare him to. And then in this one, by Walter Crane, he's a warthog. And this one here, also a warthog. Lovely picture, I have to say. This one, the princess comes back, or the woman comes back, she's not a princess, she comes back and finds, because she stayed away from him and he's languished, she has to kind of revive him at the end. The beautiful film version is by Cocteau. And there's another one at the end of the story which goes back to the earlier version of. That's by Edmond Dulac, who's an excellent illustrator. So in this story, the existence of the beast is treated as a kind of prison of solitude. So like because he's an animal, he's not hanging out with animals. He's cut off from humans. The animals do not, and even hence my hedgehog isn't hanging out with other hedgehogs. They're kind of separated from everything. So animality does not mean you're actually like an animal. You're missing the animal kind of community. You're not human, is what's happened to you. And this solitude is really only broken by being welcomed back into a kind of human discourse and social framework. And now there are also tales of animal brides, but because we're getting on here, I'm not going to do those. I'm just going to tell you the three feathers, poor Miller's boy, and the cat. Cat turns out to be a princess. You've got the reverse kind of thing. There's just fewer of them. There's only a couple of those, but there's lots of these animal bridegroom ones. But in these stories too, the animal bride stories, there's the same hybridization, and then it's resolved at the end, and usually it's been by a curse, and then you're re-entered back into the social environment. And there's lots of other stories like this too. Now, I showed you at the beginning, I hope I've got this in order here, but I just want to show you the... Yes, okay, so brother and sister, they have to leave home. It's basically a Hansel and Gretel story. They have to leave home, wicked stepmother. Stepmother pursues them. They have to change their idea. The deer drinks from a well that's been, the spell has been cast on, or actually he was a boy at the time, brother. And he drinks, and he is turned into a deer. And he hides away with his sister for a long time, but then there's a hunt going on nearby, and he can't resist. He wants to join the hunt. Now, this is kind of weird, because as a deer, you're going to be hunted. But as a boy, you'd want to join it because you'd be a hunter. But he wants to join the hunt. So he goes out and is, as you can see, he gets lightly wounded, comes back, looked after his sister, but they're tracked by the king, who comes back, falls in love with the sister, and the thing gets sorted out, he is restored to his human form at the end of the tale, and in a very interesting visual representation of this. It's like he's, like these other stories, they've removed the skin. And it's the skin which is the sign of the animal. I'm going to end off here with a variation on this animal-human transposition. And so like stories like Little Brother and Little Sister or Hans May Hedgehog, the shedding of the animal identity is a removal of the skin. Often the skin is burned or destroyed in some way. And one could say that the assumption of an animal skin, like putting one on, is also a form of entering into an animal state. And so there are several stories like this. And there is Charles Perrault's donkey skin is one version of this. Woman puts on the donkey skin, and it's time kind of to conceal her identity. But, you know, if you look at all closely, you realize she's a princess. And in All Fur, and these are often stories where women has to leave the household because, and it's usually an incest threat. So the father has taken an incestuous interest in the daughter, who's the only one. You know, the mother died, left a ring, or made had a promise or something. You have to marry someone who's only, you know, as good as me or better than me or whatever, or the person the ring fits. And so father tries all kinds of people, tests here and there, and suddenly realizes, oh yeah, of course, my daughter. I forgot my daughter. Let's see if the ring fits on her. Fits perfectly. And so the girl realizes, this is not the way things are supposed to be. And with someone's help, she leaves. And she usually requests things. So inside that bag there are some amazingly attractive gowns. And she leaves with three nice dresses. And what else would you need to leave home with? And she also asks for this suit of animal skins. And in donkey skin, the reason why she asks for the donkey skin is because this donkey is the favorite animal of the father, and the donkey is remarkable. It basically shits gold all day long. And so to ask the father to skin the donkey is to cut off a major revenue source. And so she thinks there's no way the father's going to kill the donkey. But he does. And the same thing with the all fur thing is, I want you to find me skins from 1,000 animals and make me a coat of animal skins with 1,000 animals. And I think, well, no way the father's going to find 1,000 animals to skin. Different animals. They all have to be different. And lo and behold, he does. And so she leaves wearing this. But as doing so, she kind of assumes an animal identity. And she goes and she works. She's treated poorly by people. She's sort of like a Cinderella thing. She's just stuck by the fireplace and no one pays. You know, she has to do all the hard work and everything like that. And so the story is really about the rediscovery of her identity in a new relationship with another man who's going to now recognize her, and it's going to be a proper relationship. And depending on the story, what happens to the father is either he's punished or he's had an amazing change of heart. And he comes back and he's welcomed back and, I made a mistake. Will you forgive me? Oh, yes, I'll forgive you. And so the family's reunited at the end. Here's another version of, check it out, you know. That's where she's got the animal skins, and then that's one of the dresses she's wearing underneath. And that's how she's recognized by the prince as being someone special. He looks through a keyhole and sees that she's dressed rather unusually. Sexy. But the animal skin, very pretty extraordinary, the mix of stuff in there. So there's a male version of this called bear skin, where a soldier has to go off and do the same kind of thing. He basically becomes like a wild man, like a woodwose or something like that. He goes off into the woods and assumes a kind of almost animal identity for a while. And it's a curse, you know, it's a deal he's made with the devil. He, amazingly enough, outwits the devil in the end of the story. The devil comes back to him and says, I want to thank you because when you outwitted me, you caused the death of other people. And so I actually won in the end. You know, it was better than I got five of them than one of you. So, and another one of these is a tale called Fitcher's Bird, which I'm going to end with this one because the tale I least understand in Grimm. It's a costumed character, and this woman who has been in this kind of Bluebeard situation with a man has like opened up the room, found the dead bodies that have been the previous wives that have been killed, and has been carrying around this egg, which now has a blood stain on it, which is like so heavily symbolic, I don't know what to make of it. And she dresses up as a bird. Sort of fits with the egg thing there. Interpreters have had a field day with this, and also contemporary writers. So this is a story that Margaret Atwood has rewritten, that has been rewritten by Angela Carter and other people like that. So I don't have the key to that story. So I'm now going to end off here. What I've basically been doing is a kind of big view of this, so that what I'm able to do now is go back in and read some of the stories very closely but you have to figure out where they fit in relation to other stories in the collection. The collection is extremely complicated to master because it's shorter than War and Peace, but you have way more characters doing a whole lot more things than you would in a much longer novel, because you've got 210 stories to deal with. And they're coming out of weird different traditions. So some are like out of the written tradition, some are orally transmitted, some are clearly attached in some way to some ancient mythological source, and others are silly tales that were told by the fireside from one person to another, and they're basically jokes or what they call schwank. It's a very hard collection to make sense of, but it covers a lot of stuff. And animals really run right through the entire thing. And so tonight what I've tried to do is move progressively from animals speaking with animals to animals speaking with humans to humans themselves becoming animals and then kind of like sort of becoming animals. And we've also had a look at some pictures. So, what I've tried to do is get an overall approach to the issues. And I have to say, we do not learn very much about animals when we read the Brothers Grimm. Sorry. But there is a bonus on the side. We do learn a lot about ourselves in relation to them. And this is actually quite relevant to our current situation. We're finding out about sympathy to animals, to listen to them, and not to offend them. Because if we do, we're going to fail in attempts to attain our own human goals. And if we're exceptionally insensitive to animals, we may be punished. So there's a kind of a warning in there. Though animals speak, we do not learn the language of animals, because they speak in the language of men. And this language, as Lessing and Herder point out, is nothing unusual. It's proper for animals to speak in our language. Now, of course, this is pure anthropomorphization. You know, the animals are treated as humans and all this kind of stuff. But this is an unavoidable feature whenever we approach something that's other to us, that we are definitely going to recuperate them into our own idea of what we are. We're going to remake them, in other words. And interestingly, using human language to communicate with animals is, and I actually went and I tried to read up on this, is, as some writers and animal trainers maintain, part of a necessary repertoire to connect with animals. Like our speech and our conversation with the animals is actually part of an actual exchange that can take place. So, in the moral hierarchy in the tales, the animals really exist outside the human world and therefore kind of set a standard for human behavior. As a wolf is a wolf. It's not like you don't get wolves pretending to be wolves. Sometimes they pretend to be, they act like humans. But they don't get themselves disguised. And, well, occasionally you get, well, wolf in sheep's clothing. Yes, except that, yes, okay, the sheep, that wolf is unusual. Yeah, that wolf is very strange, the wolf of Little Red Riding Hood. You're right, he gets dressed up. And, they speak with us, we enter into a kind of sympathetic relations with them, but in the end, their world is separate from our world of moral meaning. So even if we become an animal because of a curse, we actually remain separated from animals, not part of the animal world. And in the end, we return in the stories always to a human state. I think there's only one example of someone who's a poodle in one of the stories, someone who's turned into a poodle, who doesn't get changed out of being a poodle by the end of the story. So normally everyone gets changed. Even the bird in Juniper Tree, you know, who's actually a spirit, at the end, poof, he's back as the boy reborn. So so in my reading, despite many temptations to read otherwise, animals are not allegorical or symbolic representations, because there's no, like, I can't find an external moral code overtly or secretly buried in the tales. And of course, there are many attempts to moralize the stories or allegorize them by Freudians, Jungians, believers in solar mythology, very popular in the 19th century. And in my view, nothing should stop us from making these interpretations. But we should keep in mind these beautiful words by August Wilhelm Schlegel, a contemporary of the Grimms. Adults usually already have too much in their heads to give themselves up to a wholly uninhibited play of fantasy. They cannot imagine that it is done with a mere simple fairy tale, and so they allegorize it, interpret it, because they believe there must indeed be something hidden behind it. And that doesn't mean there's nothing that can be said. It's just you have to be careful about it. So, my tale is done. See the mouse run. So, thanks. Yeah, I can answer a couple of questions. Yeah, how long was I going for? About an hour, maybe?
Yeah,
just
a little bit
more.
Does anyone have any questions?
Can't ask hard ones, though. There's just such a vast, like I'm far enough into this to know how big it is, and so there's just a vast amount of ways that different cultures and traditions have sorted things out, and so if you know, if I were a Stith Thompson, who's like the dean of folklore, people died many years ago, but knew, had read them all basically and categorized and indexed everything, if you could do that, you probably would be able to say, well, yes, that's true over there, but over there it's a little bit different or whatever. And so I would say that I'm not aware of I'm certainly aware of animal tales as being a category, but I'm not aware of a subcategory of them. But it does not surprise me to hear that there is one, especially in a particular cultural realm. Yeah. So, I mean, I certainly divide the tales up into all kinds of different ways, yeah. But that's interesting because you would probably have different kinds of animal activities if that's the case. Well, that would be like, you know, because basically I've done that similar kind of division in a way. I've said there are these animal tales, which is the 27 or so, which really are just animals talking to animals. And then there is this next group of animals and humans, which is much more common. That's your kind of helper-donor kind of relationship that people have with the animals. And then there's the other category where the animals and the humans are kind of mixed up there. So I suppose I've been kind of following a split like that. I'm just not aware that I'm fitting into some kind of ancient tradition. So thanks. Yeah? I think it's different, but there is a kind of an overlap, and that is, it's usually for kind of social reasons or for personal reasons, a character is sympathetic to others. So like Gretel, in my example there, is sympathetic to the duck. But then so is the tailor in The Two Travelers. You know, so that you could say there's something about, there's an overlap there, even though there's, women have pets in the stories. Men tend not to have pets. They have animals that they kind of use in some way. They're riding or whatever. But can't think of too much else about that. You know, it's something, if I'd have to go down and kind of like resort everything in my head. But it's a good question, for sure. Like a gender question is important in that.